You're listening to Talking Boat Stuff, the Waterways Podcast, where we celebrate everything in, on, and around the water. This episode was recorded live at the 2024 Toronto International Boat Show and is powered by America's Boating Channel. Now, here's your favorite captain of conversation, Stephen Bull.
All right. Talking Boat Stuff, the Waterways Podcast. Happy to have you as a guest, Mr. Craig Hamilton. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, thank you for the invite.
So, I know you very well. A lot of boaters that have been to the show for many years know you very well. Give me the self-introduction. We got the boaterskills.ca. You just came from a seminar. Let's talk about that. Yeah, there's a lot of different things we can talk about with you. But tell me about Boater Skills.
Boater Skills is a company that I started back in 2011 after having worked in the islands for a number of years, came back to Canada. There was a need for personal or private boat training, boat instruction. And there was an opportunity for me to, I think, step in and share some of the things I had learned as a captain in the Caribbean to help some boaters maybe build some confidence, get off the dock more often. You know, there's nothing sadder than seeing a boat tied to the dock all summer long. So it's worked out well, and we've worked our way up to having seven instructors now, and we're teaching boat handling and boater certifications in Ontario.
And it's power and sail, right? What are there limitations? Is there a size that we get to where it's too much?
Negative. No, we have we've got instructors with a lot of experience. Most of them are just power related. I come from a background that started in power, moved into sail, which is what I was doing in the islands, was running big sailboats. So when we're teaching here, we can cover all of the bases. In terms of length of boat, because we're on, you know, smaller inland waters, we don't get the giant, like, 90-foot yachts and so on. The biggest boat I've taught on here would probably be 70. So size isn't a factor. It's more about location. You know, can we get to those people and teach them how to operate their boat safely?
I was just talking to someone. They asked who the podcast guest was today, and I was explaining Boater Skills, and I said the beauty of it is, you know, you come and you use my boat. It's different from vehicles where, you know, every driving school can have a Honda Civic, a Toyota Tercel, whatever. And sure, there's slightly different wheelbases and turning radiuses, but, you know, there's a lot of carryover in cars, and there's not, boats are so unique. Everyone has a different handling, different shifting, and all that kind of stuff. So was that how it always started? Did you ever consider trying to have, like, a training boat and then realize it didn't work? Or was it always, let's come to your boat?
It's always been about teaching people on their own on their own vessels. We do have a boat that we can make available to somebody who has their pleasure craft operator card but hasn't yet purchased a boat. But we don't really promote it. It's more if we get a phone call and it's like, hey, can you teach us on your boat? We'll set something up. This is more about people that have already committed. They've purchased the boat that they want. Maybe they've moved on to something new. They just need some instruction on that. But really, when you compare the different ways that boats maneuver, the only thing they all really have in common is operating boats is all about thrust and drift. So when you are teaching somebody on a twin-engine power boat, you need to break it into different categories. Is it an outboard or stern drive, which is an inboard with the outboard drive? Because those operate pretty much the same. But if it's a twin-engine stern drive, there's going to be some different operation techniques compared to, let's say, a twin-engine inboard with rudders. So when you're operating one or the other, you might be using the steering wheel for your maneuvers, you might not. So one of the first things that has to be determined when you step on board a boat, whether it's you as the instructor or the student, the owner, is learning how your particular boat maneuvers, how it responds to a single engine thrust, a twin engine thrust. Do we need the wheel? Do we not use the wheel? So figuring out those characteristics first, getting comfortable with maneuvering the vessel, then moving on to things like docking, different approaches and that sort of thing. Sailboats, that's a different animal. Now we're talking about something that's got a keel, it's got a very deep rudder, they're going to be single engine. You can even break those into categories of twin rudder boats, which gets into a whole other animal. That's more the racing design, because when a boat is on a heavy heel, you've got at least one rudder completely submerged. And if the boat tacks or jibes, now you're on the other tack, and now that rudder's in the water, so you get better grip. And that's more of a performance thing. But when it comes to docking boats, you know, if I'm stepping into the marina and I go down to the boat and I see what I'm going to be teaching on, I have to have already an idea of how that particular boat maneuvers so that I can then pass that on to the student. Regardless, you know, you're still going to start with the very, very basics. Get it off the dock and try.
And I love the, you know, the advice, go out in the lake when you have some time and, you know, be in a safe area with lots of water and you know, for to use a technical term here, mess around a bit. Try and spin it. See if you can do a 360. Try backing up and turning. See how responsive it is. What's your line? Like, get used to how it handles away from the dock before you approach the dock.
Sure. One step at a time. It's sort of the training wheel approach to things,
right.
I think. You know, I just came from teaching a boat handling seminar, which we love doing at the Toronto Boat Show because you get a great audience. Everybody's enthusiastic. And one of the slides that I put up in our PowerPoint is the three major factors that make docking in the wind difficult. And the number one is people trying to drive a boat like it's a car. I get a lot of students that after a three-hour session is done, I've taught them a number of skills. They'll say, you know, I thought this was going to be like driving my, you know, my Honda or whatever it might be. And they realize very quickly that in a boat, when you turn the wheel, it stays turned. In a car, it comes back for you, right? So it's important to always understand that when you are underway, especially at slow speeds, and this is barring that there's any wind or current issues, just operating that boat at slow speeds, they're going to wander a little bit. Being able to maneuver the wheel to keep it on track at slow speeds, but always knowing where the wheel is turned, because if you've turned the wheel and gone to neutral and then you move the wheel and go back in gear, it's going to go wherever you move the wheel to. So we got to get people thinking about hand-eye coordination, knowing where the wheel is, or the rudder in this case, and using a technique I call shift and drift, which is to control our boat speed. Knowing that if we do need to turn a boat, you got to have the wheel turned first. So you need to have power. You need to be in gear to steer. Little saying I came up with a while ago.
Yeah, I like that one. That one's counterintuitive to new. I've been fortunate enough to be behind the wheel of hundreds of different vessels from PWCs up, not to the level of you, but you get to know that intuitively if you drive enough boats. But when you first start, you're like driving a car, you're near something, there's potential danger, your instinct is, I'm going to slow down, but that actually makes things more difficult. We're not saying speed up and go fast, but the boat isn't going to stop, it's going to drift.
Well, a boat in motion stays in motion in a liquid environment or a fluid environment. So always having like sort of a plan when you're approaching close quarters or docks and so on, knowing where it is you eventually want to end up, and then at the same time getting the boat doing what you need it to do. So you need to really be in tune with it. And certainly the more you slow down, you start to lose some of the steerage, wind can become a factor. You know, once the wind finds the side of a boat, if you're not moving fast enough, it's going to carry the boat. And in many cases, the bow is going to blow off first. So, you know, we're always trying to get people to be thinking one step ahead, but to have a plan.
That's probably one of the big overarching advices. Doesn't matter what type of boat it is, power, sail, size, anticipation. Know what your next step, but know what you're trying to do and have a general idea of what you want to, how you want to achieve that.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, last year when we were invited back to the show for the seminars, Kim Blair, who organizes all of the seminars here, she's wonderful to work with, she asked me if I could do something a little different in my seminars other than just basic boat handling. And I said, well, we could bring in docking in the wind because that's everybody's biggest challenge. And so when we started approaching it from that perspective, we kind of had to start to say, okay, well, look, you need some basic skills first. But then once you actually get the boat out into the wind, you got to remember that not every day is a boating day, right? And when you get those days, if you're in particular a power boater, because we want the calm days, if you have... let's say Uncle Bob and Aunt Jane are coming down for a boat ride and you haven't been out in 3 weeks and they've just driven 3 hours to get to you and you get down to the marina, you feel that pressure to get off the dock with them, right? You promise it to them, but it's blowing 15 knots. You wouldn't normally probably go out in 15 knots of wind on a powerboat. Sailors, that's a whole different world. We want the wind. you know.
I always joke about that when we're looking out at waves and being like, you know, we have the right type of boat, where I look at that and say, let's not go out today. And my sailing buddies are like, whoa, here we go.
Well, and certainly some of us more than others, I guess, we like that challenge. But, you know, back to this power boating thing, I always recommend my students stand on the dock and assess the wind before they leave the dock. Granted that, you know, maybe it's not too bad now, but ask yourself, if I am going to cast off and leave in these conditions, can I get back in? Am I right on the envelope of my limits, my skill set? And what happens if the wind picks up 5 knots? What happens if the wind changes direction 10 or 15 degrees, where it's no longer a positive wind that would, you know, let me drift my boat onto the dock? Now it's blowing me away. So there are just so many factors to consider in learning how to operate a boat, from the size of the boat, the experience, where you're operating it, the conditions, the space that you're maneuvering within. And then we can get into other areas of, well, how do you mitigate risk? Well, first of all, learn how to operate your boat. But secondly, proper fender placement, things like corner guards on docks so that you're not, you know, tearing down the side of your boat if you do get a little too close to the end. These are all things that maybe a lot of people don't consider. But if you're coming back to your slip and your experience level maybe isn't quite up to the conditions, anything you did to prepare for this is going to help your confidence. I'm always concerned that if you have someone who is just learning, they've had several very successful dockings, because docking is always going to be the bigger challenge, right? They've had several good dockings, and then today everything goes wrong. And now their confidence is shot. And now the boat sits on the dock, and they're afraid to go out. So when it comes down to that, operating any kind of a boat in the wind, it's having a plan, knowing how to operate your boat and control it for those conditions. But secondly, knowing when to say, okay, this is too much.
Yeah, that's good advice. And on the one hand, it's that sort of 10,000 hours idea that the more you do it, the more you take it off the dock, the better you will be, and the more less ideal weather you boat in, the better you are at handling that. But don't bite off more than you can chew, because you don't want things to go wrong. It's a big investment. And not to forget, there's a lot of other investments tied up. So it's not just yours that might be an issue. You don't want to bump into someone else. So we're kind of in the weeds here, but here's a question that I've been asked a couple times at the this Toronto Boat Show. Prop wash. So like...
Prop walk, sorry.
How big of a concern, like how much should people worry about that? And well, let's start. What is it?
Okay, prop walk, generally when we're talking about prop walk, we're talking more about sailboats. There is on a single engine power boat a prop walk, I'll come back to that. But on a sailboat, depending on how far forward the propeller is, if it's out, you know, very close to the back, the stern, because these are all going to be fixed shafts with a rudder for steerage, when you put the boat into reverse, it has like a paddle wheel effect that the boat will start to move backwards, but then it's going to start to go off either to port or to starboard. So it's not going to just go straight back. So when you're operating a sailboat, you have to understand, first of all, what is your prop walk if you even have it? And secondly, how do you overcome it? Well, if you bring your boat, a sailboat, to a full stop, shift it into reverse with a neutral helm, just maybe with a couple of extra RPMs added in just to get the boat moving. Then just look to see if the boat starts to trail off to the right, starboard, or to the left, port. That determines whether you've got port or starboard prop walk. Once the boat gets enough speed in reverse, now the rudder takes over. You start to get what's called rudder effect. It will overdrive or overcome that prop walk, and now you have steerage in reverse. So whenever I'm teaching somebody how to dock a sailboat, the very first thing we do off the dock, let's determine if it has port or starboard prop walk or none whatsoever. Then I teach them how to overcome it, because that prop walk can work for you. If your prop walk, for example, is to port, and you're bringing your dock, your boat alongside a dock, like let's say the fuel dock, my prop walk is to port, I want to dock on port side. I'll come in on just a little bit of an angle so the bow's closer than the stern. And as I close in on the dock, I shift to reverse, add a little bit of power. That slows the boat down to a stop, but at the same time, it brings the stern in. So if you were to try to come in parallel and do that, your bow would leave the dock. So this is just a way to make prop walk work for you. So once you've determined it, it can be a positive thing. It can also mess you up too. But now there's other factors too that just quickly I'll mention. If you have prop walk and you don't like it, you can get rid of it by changing your propeller. There are different types of designs out there. One's called a very prop, which means that your fixed blades that you normally find on a propeller, when you shift to reverse, they change angle to accommodate a reverse thrust, and that helps to eliminate some of the prop lock.
That's cool.
And you can get that for powerboats as well. Now, when we talk about powerboats, where you would see prop lock coming in, it's more specifically for a single engine powerboat. Let's say you've got a 16-foot day boat with an outboard motor. If you turn the wheel all the way to port and you go into reverse, the boat may turn beautifully going to port just like you wanted it to. But turn the wheel to starboard and go into reverse and it may not turn. It'll just kind of go straight back and keep going, and that's because there's a prop lock there. Now, it could be either or, port or starboard. But just learning the characteristics of your boat. Where's the prop lock? When does it come on? Well, frankly, when you're in gear. You don't get prop lock if you're in neutral. And how can we overcome it, or how can we make it work for us?
Yeah, I need to find an animator to do something for it, because the it is a straightforward thing once you understand what it's doing. You mentioned the paddle wheel effect, but I mean, a lot of people have a hard time visualizing it. But you know, if you see a propeller or anything pushing wind or waves, you know, it's going to go in a spiral, and that spiral is going to kind of go out, and that's what we're talking about. For every action, there's an equal opposite reaction. So if it's pushing water one way, that means the boat is getting a slight push the other way. And I think animating that would be good. But yeah, so it's like single screws, and yeah, it's really noticeable on our tender. It'll, as you're saying, beautifully one direction, and the other way, it sometimes won't even turn.
Nope. You'll see the bow come off a little bit, yeah, but it just tends to go straight back. And the only way to overcome it, and this would work, is if you just add a little bit of throttle. It will eventually bite and pull. Now, if you were to take a twin-engine power boat, let's, for example, take a 36 Sea Ray. So you've got inboard engines, that's straight shafts with rudders for steerage. Those are the most easy to maneuver in close quarters and at slow speeds, because you just simply center up the wheel and you just go to the shifters. So you're going to have four sticks. You're going to have one transmission and one throttle for each engine. If you go to just the transmissions and you shift right engine starboard in reverse, you should see the boat start to go to port. If you shift the port engine in reverse, you should see the back of the boat start to go to starboard. So it kind of goes the opposite direction. And that helps us when we're doing our maneuvers to back into a slip. Two engines in the same direction, it goes straight. So in a sense, you're seeing prop lock on a single engine shift in reverse, or even forward. You'll see the bow go the opposite direction. If you shift left forward, port forward, you'll see the bow go to starboard. So that's another example of prop lock.
Yeah, I think actually my wife got this from you, because we have that exact setup on our boat. And when she's docking, because I do most of the driving just because of the show, but she's an excellent boat handler, she sticks her thumbs out, so on top of the throttle, so if she puts one forward and one back, we're going to go harder. Another one that I've heard that I've shared with people is it's like driving a shopping cart at a grocery store. You're walking down and you want to turn down aisle 5. You don't wait like a cart so you're right there and have a turn that's going to bite. You've got to anticipate. And if you've got to turn that cart harder, you're pulling back on one and pushing on the other. So oversimplification, but same kind of idea. And the more you do it, the more comfortable you are with it.
Yes, and we also have to remember, too, that boats steer from the back, right? So if I'm operating a boat, I'm going to have more control driving backwards than I will forwards at slow speeds. I can just use one engine or the other to steer the boat. It's very similar to the bulldozer process. If you're driving a bulldozer, one track or the other is going to turn. On a powerboat with twin engines, if you go two engines forward, it should go straight. If you go two engines reverse, it should go straight, providing you haven't altered the rudder.
Right. And then there's so many, you know, the technology changes all the time with the twin engine outboards. So many of them have joystick docking, and then there's pod drives, and there's bow and stern thrusters, which I think are wonderful, and I've used all of them at different times. I'm a believer, and it's not because I'm some old school sailor that's saying I don't like technology, but I am a believer in using those only when you have to, because it's very quick to train yourself out of the handling abilities.
It's true. Now, you know, joystick control, most children could learn how to dock the boat just because they've got that hand-eye coordination from all the video games they might play, right? But if I'm teaching a student that has, let's say, either a bow thruster, or maybe they have a bow thruster and a stern thruster, or they have joysticks, they don't get to use them initially in the lesson. I will cover it at the end of the lesson, but they need to learn how to drive the boat onto with the sticks first. You know, old school, if you will. You know, a bow thruster, for example, should never be used to turn the boat. It's only used to just push your bow into the dock or take it off the dock. It's just for these short little 2 to 3 second bursts. The same with the stern. You know, you don't stand on your thrusters to walk the boat sideways unless you're just trying to close in a foot or two. You should be able to develop the skills to learn how to shift and drift your boat to get it into a position, just using the shifters or the wheel or a combination thereof, and then fine-tune it with everything else.
Yeah, I added, so for season two of Waterways TV, I picked up a 1994 Monterey 265 single screw, you know, not cutty cabin, pocket cruiser, you'd call it. But it's been a while since I've driven a single screw. It probably should have two because it's a little tender, but, you know, it is what it is. You get a boat. Maybe that's the first boat you get. We did add, the side shift stern thruster sort of halfway through the journey from Toronto to New York around Montreal, and it made the second run of locks that much easier. But, yeah, we weren't using it to push in. We'd be in the lock. I'd be up at the bow. My father-in-law was driving. You know, he's got the remote, so he could just sort of push the bow a little bit back closer to the wall if you needed to. But yeah, you see people in the locks that will just drive in the middle and try and use that the whole time. And all I think is you're going to burn out your motors aside from it not being best practice. Like, that's not what it's designed to do.
It's not. And depending on the boat manufacturer, is that a proper thruster that was installed? Is it borderline for strength? You know, once you get to a certain wind strength, the thrusters aren't going to do anything for you. The wind's going to overcome you. The joysticks are a little bit different because you're using the engines where you've got almost unlimited power to be able to push a boat sideways and such. I actually had a student or two students a couple of years ago had bought a brand new boat. It was in about the 36-foot range. It had the joystick with the pods, so you could literally walk that boat sideways. And when I got to the boat, I said, guys, I'd really like to teach you first on the sticks. And they're like, no. Just show us the joystick. I'm like, well, it's going to be an easy day for me, but I'm going to feel when I leave here that I didn't do enough, because if that system fails for whatever reason, one engine stops responding, the computer goes down or whatever, you're going to have to use the sticks. Now, something we haven't mentioned here was contingency plans. And this applies regardless of what kind of boat you're operating. When things go wrong, do you have a plan to be able to go somewhere different that might be easier for your docking? And in most cases, you know, if I'm operating a joystick and one engine goes down, I can't use the joystick anymore, I might go to the fuel dock instead of trying to back in between my dock and another boat, you know, where I'm reducing the risk, taking a lot of pressure off myself, because I know that as I'm coming into the marina, if it's a technical issue with the boat or a weather issue, that I'm not going to have an easy go of it, that I know I've got a backup place to go to. And it eliminates a lot of stress. And to some degree, it's a safety thing too, right?
Yeah, and speaking of safety, something that I included in the show, and I unfortunately was able to get a photo of it from, I think it was a Missouri State Police, anyway, a Lake of the Ozarks, a fuel dock. Someone didn't run their blowers, there was an issue, and there was an explosion. Everyone survived, but that's one that a lot of people, I don't think, know about, whether they haven't been told or they haven't seen the signs. They just think, okay, I fueled up, everything's good to go. Tell me why it's important to run your blowers at the gas dock, you know, what they do, and what could go wrong if you don't.
Okay, let's compare a boat's engine compartment enclosed compared to a car. A car's engine compartment, there's nothing underneath, right? So there's airflow through the engine compartment, and there's nowhere for fumes to really get trapped other than if they get inside the car itself. Boats, on the other hand, if you have an inboard engine, meaning you've got to lift a lid to see the motor, then there's always the potential that there could be either a fuel leak directly from the tank or from the engine itself. And as that boat sits there over time, not being used, those fumes can build up. Also, if you're fueling the boat up, you're now filling it right to the top, and there's the potential for fumes to build up just on the fill, okay? So these blowers are designed to be operated for a minimum of 4 minutes. It's actually a law. You'll see the signage at all of the fuel docks here in Canada to run your blower for 4 minutes before you turn the key. That's going to eliminate any of the fumes that are inside. It's kind of similar to the stove, the exhaust fan above your stove, which eliminates, you know, smoke and cooking odors. Well, run your blower for 4 minutes, and this is gas, right? Gas is a far less stable fuel than diesel is. So you see on the signs at the marina, gas-powered vessels, you must run the blower for 4 minutes before starting the engine. It's just a safety. When you turn that key, that's when there's the risk of a spark. Now, boat engines are all designed with protection, like equipment that's designed specifically so there's no sparks. Doesn't mean somebody hasn't gone in there and changed something. When you turn the key, that's when there's the risk of a spark and risk of an explosion. But also you might have a hot manifold that's got fuel dripping on it, and you pull away from the dock and then it explodes, which is something that happened in Oakville on 16 Mile Creek and literally blew three people out of the boat. So that risk is, maybe it's not that common, but the more important thing is, can it happen? Yes.
Yeah, and it's the, you know, the line I use with my 8-year-old when we're talking about safety stuff is, nobody plans on having an accident, so plan on the, you know, the contingency and all that kind of stuff. So I've said that too. I even said that in the show when I was talking about it. I'm like, you probably go your whole boating career and never see this, let alone have it happen to you, but it can happen, and so why not take a couple minutes and just make sure you're not that, you know, story that we're talking about and example that we're using.
And I think you find, when you compare the boating world to the car or automobile world, you see much older boats out there than you do see much older cars, right? Mostly because of usage, cars get burned out a little bit faster. But I see a lot of boats that are like from the 80s and 90s. Some have been well taken care of, others not so much. And when I step on board those boats to teach, I really emphasize the blower side of things. I take an extra minute to just open up the engine compartment if the student's not familiar with it and explain it. I show them how the system works and I give them a tip. When you operate your blower, hop out of the boat, walk over to the side of the boat where the vents are, where that air is being blown out overboard, and give it a sniff. If you smell fumes in that, there's a problem. If it just smells like an engine room, then you're probably fine. Still, we want you to run it for the 4 minutes. But here in Ontario, we have what's called the TSSA regulations for fuel delivery. And so I'm teaching at a lot of the marinas here a fuel dock safety course that it reminds the employees and the staff at the fuel dock, look, here's the three main rules. Every engine has to be turned off before fuel delivery. Everybody must be off the boat, and there is zero exception. Let me come back to that. And third, you have to run the blower if it's gas-powered for 4 minutes after you've started the engine. The best time to do that, by the way, is when the fuel attendant has just finished filling the boat, and you're now going to go inside to pay for the fuel. Well, that takes 3, 4, 5 minutes, right? That's the perfect time to run the blower.
Yeah, just pop on, flip the switch, and then go do your thing.
Come back, and you're all ready to go. Now, in some cases, I even recommend, hey, look, open up the engine compartment, takes 10 seconds, have a look, make sure there's nothing floating in the bilge that might indicate there was actually a proper spill, right? And while you're doing that, you're introducing a lot more air to get rid of any fumes that might still be in there.
Yeah, I'm glad that you do the fuel dock safety too, because, you know, it's one, ultimately responsibility is on the boat owner and the captain. But if you don't know, it's safety's on everyone and you're fueling. I'm not going to say which one, but there was a marina on Lake Ontario I was at, and it was busy summer. I filled up. The kid at the fuel dock, you know, goes to help untie, and I said, well, hang on, I got to run the blowers because we got boats waiting for you. We got to get going. And instead of getting into it, I just said to him, like, okay, well, can you just put in writing that your insurance is going to cover any damage if something happens? And he said, what? I said, well, you got a sign right there that says 4 minutes. I'll go, but just can you just write down your name and take responsibility?
That's a very important point, because, and the bottom line is this, if a fuel attendant fails to you know, have the signage posted there, all the marinas have to have that signage posted. If there's anything goes wrong, that's on the marina. and this in particular comes back to the point I wanted to make about getting off the boat. If you don't have everybody off the vessel and an explosion occurs, that's on the marina, because they are supposed to make sure everybody is off. Now, there are times where you might have a disability on board the boat, and you might get an argument from the boat handler saying, you know, we can't get this person off because they need a wheelchair and all of that. And this is not to be insensitive at all. This is about lives, right? I would say to that owner, how did you get them on? How are you going to get them off? Because if you can do either of those, you can do it for this. And ultimately, if this person is on board a boat that explodes, that's just not acceptable.
Yeah, there's always going to be people looking for the out. But
And if I just could add one more thing here, we're not trying to put a fear factor into everybody. It's just a very simple matter. You know, in most cases, it's a very safe activity. And if you're refueling the boat, you follow a couple of simple rules. You know, it's like you pull into the gas station. If you happen to be a smoker, you're not going to have a cigarette going while you're filling your car.
Yeah.
Well, apply some simple basic rules to your boat. Turn everything off.
It's like the view about big water and all that stuff. You know, no one worth their salt will say be afraid of water, but you got to respect it.
Oh, definitely, because the water always wins.
Yep.
Mother Nature always wins.
All right, lots of good safety tips. We could talk about this for hours. Before I let you go, because I know you're busy and you're going to enjoy the show yourself, which will be lovely, let's take 5 minutes and talk about your fascinating backstory, because you've been all over the world boating. You're in the Caribbean. What are a couple bullet points of your background, how you ended up here? Because you've been a charter captain, you've delivered boats, you've dove under boats to fix stuff in the Pacific. If you ever see Craig Hamilton, by the way, at a marina bar, sidle up to him and ask him some stories, because he's got good ones.
I grew up like many other good Canadians with a cottage and a small power boat, and Dad encouraged us to, you know, learn how to drive the boat, go fishing, all that sort of thing. And then it was a few years, I guess, when I became a scuba diver. I was working towards my dive master's. I was down in the Florida Keys. This is going back when I was in my 20s. The captain of the dive boat, I'm up on the flybridge talking to him, and he's like, you'd make a good captain. I'm like, no, there's no way I want to do something like that. No, seriously, you should think about doing this. And it kind of went into the back of my head, and I didn't think too much more about it. And so I continued doing, you know, my dive master things while I was working I had a television background, much like yourself. And I got invited to go down to the islands at one point with my partner. She and I got invited to go down and be crew on a liveaboard sailing vessel in the British Virgin Islands, and just to be dive masters for a year. And then we thought, well, then what do we do afterwards? So we sat down and we waited out. Do we quit our jobs here in Ontario, go to the islands for a year, do all of this dive mastering stuff on a liveaboard boat, and then come home and start over? Like, how does this all work out? Well, we made two columns, positive, negative. Positives outweighed the negatives. We put everything into storage, and within a month, we were down in the islands on a boat. That job turned into another job with me actually as a captain. And then I went to England and got my yacht master's, my 200-ton, which allowed me to work internationally in other areas. So we spent a total of 5 years in the Caribbean. So I actually ended up becoming a captain, just like that.
He was right.
That U.S. captain said, which I just didn't see that happening. And after 5 years of running charters, we were all up and down the Leewards, the Windwards, down to Grenada, British Virgin Islands in general, Puerto Rico, all that sort of thing. You're living on a boat. You're operating it in all kinds of conditions. No bow thrusters, no stern thrusters, and you're forced to learn quickly. And all of the things that I'm teaching now are things I got from that period in my life where I'm operating different kinds of boats in all these different conditions, what worked and what didn't work. So when we took a break to come back to Canada, the intent was to go back and work on power boats, get away from the sailing side, because the power boat was a little bit easier on the crew, you know, less line pulling and that sort of thing. We come home for a year. I get sucked back into my old TV job. I end up actually at the Weather Network producing the national show. And after about, 6 months of that, it was like, I can't do this stuff anymore, man. This is a young man's game to be in a control room and too much activity, you know, too many flashing lights and such. So I said to my wife, what do you think? She said, why don't you teach? So I left the Weather Network. I started Boater Skills, put together a website, talked to some yacht brokers I knew that had been selling boats and their new clients needed some help. And it just started to steamroll from there. And now we're up to 7 instructors, and we've got contracts with the City of Toronto. We're doing all kinds of things. Not only the dock safety training for employees in marinas, but I'm teaching for Boating Ontario, and it's just, it keeps going. Keeps going. I can't believe how big this is getting, and it's so exciting.
Well, it just shows, you know, the need there is for it, from the recreational people up to the municipalities, the dock staff, everything.
There are plenty of staff that require, like every year I go to Sudbury with one of my other instructors, and we train geologists on how to drive boats. Because they have to use these little tinnies, you know, with a 9 horsepower on the back to get out to those locations to poke the rocks or whatever they do to those rocks. And they also need marine first aid. So because I was no longer running charters all year round, I became a Red Cross first aid instructor so I could also teach marine first aid during the off season. Well, that's created another whole business, which now I'm busy teaching dental offices and other things. So we're doing first aid, we're doing all kinds of courses for boaters. It's worked deeply into staff training now, not just private instruction. But my heart is still in getting on the boat with you, showing you how to dock that boat so it's fun, it's safe, you can get out there and enjoy it.
Perfect. And if you want to find out, boaterskills.ca, tell Craig Waterway sent you. That'll get you an answered email. That's the only promise I'm going to make. Thanks for joining us here live at the Toronto International Boat Show. Hope the rest of your seminars go good, and I hope you get some time to go wander around, kick the tires, as it were, for yourself.
Thanks so much for the invite.